Support comes from Empower Missouri's Affordable Housing Coalition, working to address the causes of housing insecurity and homelessness through tenant advocacy. Information at empowermissouri.org/housing.
From St. Louis Public Radio. This is Politically Speaking.
Democrat Raja Krishnamoorthy has amassed an impressive campaign war chest of $28 million in his quest to replace Dick Durbin in the Senate. And he's arguably the frontrunner in this Democratic primary, holding a commanding lead in the polls over fellow U.S. Representative Robin Kelly and Lieutenant Governor Juliana Stratton. But the self-described radical common-sense prosperity Democrat has taken some heat from his rivals, particularly over campaign finance. On this episode of Politically Speaking, we ask Krishnamoorthy about those differences and why he should be Illinois' next U.S. Senator. Let's hit the music.
This is the Politically Speaking podcast, an in-depth examination of Missouri and Illinois politics.
The instant we got to Illinois, we joined the Green Party. This was 2000.
So I've tried to push for those that I think are honest and really care about the future of the city.
You know, this wasn't a path that I thought I would choose in 2012 when I was able to win the closest Republican victory in the nation.
If it's something that will help Southern Illinois, I'll work with him on it. If there's something he's doing wrong, then you got to fight him on it.
I believe very strongly in the Second Amendment. I believe less government is better, and I believe local control is better.
I choose to fight for working families and for union members.
Welcome to Politically Speaking. I'm St. Louis Public Radio's Metro East reporter, Will Bauer. Our first guest today is a voice that you know well. He covers St. Louis and Missouri and Illinois politics for St. Louis Public Radio.
Jason Rosenbaum.
And our other guest is making his debut on the Politically Speaking podcast. He's one of the three major Democrats vying for the seat of retiring U.S. Senator Dick Durbin.
Hello, this is Congressman Raja Krishnamoorthy.
Congressman, thank you so much for making the time. And maybe before we jump into all the issues and the campaign, we wanted to know a little bit more about your background. So you first ran for elected office in 2010, got elected to the U.S. House in 2016. What else should we know about Raja Krishnamoorthy?
Well, maybe a little bit about my backstory. I was born in India, came to this country when I was 3 months old to Buffalo, New York. My father was studying engineering and things were going well. And then suddenly they did not in the recession of the early 1970s. My father lost his income, but thanks to the generosity of the American people, we were allowed to move into public housing and food stamps. And spent a good portion of my early childhood in those programs. Then my father got on his feet and then got a great job in, of all places, Peoria, Illinois. And so moved to Peoria and moved into the middle class. And, you know, pretty much every night at the dinner table, my father would say, think of the greatness of this country. And whatever the two of you do, my brother and me, just make sure it's there for the next families who need it. And so that became the North Star of my personal compass. So, you know, fast forward through college and law school, came back to Illinois, worked in the private and the public sectors, ran a small business, and then got elected to Congress. And so here I am 10 years later, still pursuing that mission statement my parents gave me, make sure this country is there for the next families who need it. And so that's become my why.
Oh, yeah, I got to ask this question, Will, as I put on this hat. I don't know if you can see it, but I'm a diehard White Sox fan. Are you a White Sox fan or a Cubs fan?
I am a Cubs fan, my friend. In fact, in Peoria, people grew up either a Cubs fan or a Cardinals fan. And so I happened to grow up as a Cubs fan. And so I'm an eternal optimist. Let me put it that way.
I won't hold that against you, but we'll get back to the actual questions now.
So why are you running for U.S. Senate, Congressman?
I'm running to preserve, protect, and defend the American dream, which I think is slipping out of the grasp of millions of people, especially now during the chaos of Donald Trump. You can just look at my personal story to understand why, you know, that legal immigration system that enabled us to come to this country is being actively dismantled. The public housing and food stamps that enabled us to survive are on the chopping block now. And the public schools in Peoria, as well as across the country, that enabled us a gateway to the American dream, are under attack as Donald Trump actually seeks to close the Department of Education. And so I think we're left with one central question, which is what kind of a government do we want? You know, do we want a government that's there for those fighting to make it? Or do we want a government that's primarily catering to those who have it made? And I think we desperately need a government that's trying to nurture the American dream for everyone, regardless of who you are.
So in nearly all the polls that I've seen, you've led the pack. So maybe how have you approached this primary as someone who's gotten out to an early lead in the polls, also have a massive fundraising advantage? And I'm just imagining there's some critics out there that are going to say you've maybe peaked too early.
Well, I think that at this point, the way I approach it is it's nice to lead some polls, but the only poll that counts is March 17th. And that's the day when we find out whether I got the endorsement of the people of Illinois. And so that's really what I'm seeking to do. I'm crisscrossing the state. I think I'm probably the most active by far in terms of visiting, for instance, the St. Louis area, Metro East area. I've been there. I've lost track of the number of times I've visited, but also other parts of Illinois. I'm also trying to, you know, highlight the issues that I care about deeply that I would want to work on in Washington, D.C., in the Senate. And then obviously I'm a son of downstate of Illinois, being from Peoria. So I believe that the next U.S. Senator has to represent all of Illinois, not just one portion.
So you're a member of the New Democrat Coalition, which is the center-left caucus among House Democrats. So in terms of ideology, how would you focus on governing as a U.S. Senator?
Well, I call myself a radical common sense prosperity Democrat. And what that means is I believe that, you know, our party has to be one that primarily focuses on making sure America remains a country of economic opportunity, regardless of whether you're working poor, middle class, or growing a business. And so I've spent, you know, much of my time in Congress on these issues. And I believe right now that's appropriate because I think people feel a real economic crunch, whether it's because of tariffs or whether they're losing their health insurance under the what Trump calls the big, beautiful bill. I call it the large, lousy law, or just because the price of everything is skyrocketing. I guess the other part of this is I've spent a career standing up to bullies and bad actors in Congress. And now I think we need somebody who's ready to stand up to the bullying of Donald Trump with regard to any number of issues, whether it's ICE and CBP, or whether it is, you know, basically freezing funding for Illinois for just random reasons that appear political and arbitrary on their face that hurt ordinary working people. Regardless, you need somebody who's going to stand on principle and stand up to the administration as well.
One of the things I've noticed when I'm looking at the three major candidates in terms of endorsements is I'm not surprised the lieutenant governor has the support of the governor and some other statewide officials. But are you surprised that more of your congressional colleagues haven't endorsed you? And actually Congresswoman Kelly has more congressional endorsements, or is that just because the Congressional Black Caucus endorsed her and by kind of that, all the people in that caucus came with it, and I really shouldn't read too much in that.
You should see that we have dozens of people that have endorsed me from Congress. But on top of that, I think that we should look at who are the rank and file leaders in Illinois supporting. So I have, for instance, the most support of any of the candidates among labor unions. We have 14 labor unions endorsing me. I have, I think, the most support among downstate leaders. I have 100 downstate leaders who've endorsed me, 100 black pastors, 50 Latino pastors, numerous others. So this rank and file leadership matters because these are the people that work closely with me and know exactly what I would be doing for them as a U.S. senator.
So arguably one of the most testy or contested issues in this race has been over campaign finance, and I'm sure you're tired of talking about it, but we did want to talk a little bit about Juliana Stratton, right, has criticized you for taking money from Trump-aligned groups, like an executive from Palantir, which has contracts with ICE. You then donated that money to immigrant rights groups, and you've responded by saying that she's a hypocrite because she's not taking corporate PAC money directly this cycle, but the super PAC supporting her has taken corporate PAC money, and she has in previous cycles too. So what do you think voters should know maybe about the differentiation between you and some of the other candidates around campaign finance?
Well, one thing is I'm kind of one of the original co-sponsors or sponsors of campaign finance reform, period, in Congress. I desperately think that the campaign finance system we have is messed up. And for instance, Citizens United needs to be overturned, and we've got to get back to a position where there are real limits on how much can be spent. And we need to have full transparency as to, you know, who is donating what. The other thing people should know about me is that I have almost 90,000 individual donors who have supported me over time, and that has given me a tremendous amount of independence as a Democrat. And I think the reason why these folks support me and my constituents have reelected me five times is because, for instance, I've gone after big tobacco for fueling the vaping epidemic. I have gone after food conglomerates who poison our baby food with toxic heavy metals. Both of those investigations, by the way, resulted in bipartisan regulation for the first time of these areas. I've gone after OxyContin or Purdue Pharmaceuticals for peddling OxyContin, which has addicted a generation of people to opioids. And the list goes on. One of the reasons why the UFCW 881, the largest United Food and Commercial Worker Union, endorsed me is because I helped to break up the possibility of a merger between Kroger's and Albertsons, which would have led to prices being hiked and worker conditions being hurt. And, you know, that kind of helps inform my view that my individual donors, the breadth of my individual donors, helps me to make sure I'm not beholden to anyone. With regard to the lieutenant governor's attacks, I think they've been now exposed for their hypocrisy. The Chicago Sun-Times wrote a lengthy piece talking about how she has a history of corporate backing, and now with her super PACs being fueled by, private prisoner companies, as well as other ICE contractors and, corporate interests, I think we got to just end the hypocrisy and kind of get to the issues that people care about right now.
Well, I have a follow-up on a more substantive point. I think there's a lot of people within the Democratic Party that see some of these big tech companies that are kind of working with the Trump administration, like Palantir, like Amazon, like the ex-adjacent companies from Elon Musk. And they're like, whenever there's a Democratic president, day one, all these contracts are rescinded. That's not obviously a legislative decision, but what do you think of that? And would you want to use your power as a senator to look in to how some of these technologies are being infused with government? Because that would be your job to oversee that.
Absolutely. And I think that that is something that is properly within the province of Congress, its oversight duties, and we should be concerned about it. And I think that this administration has, I think, done a number of things which exceed their authority, which might, which have yet to be revealed. And we've got to investigate all of these practices, because I'm concerned about their infringement on our privacy rights, but I'm also concerned that they're just illegal and indeed unconstitutional.
Many in the maybe younger, more progressive generation of Democrats believe that minority leaders Chuck Schumer and Hakeem Jeffries are not the right people to lead the party right now. If you're elected to Senate, who do you think should lead Senate Democrats and why?
It's a good question. I think that it's got to be somebody who puts two issues front and center more than anything else, which is this issue of the affordability crisis and making sure people are on a path to the American dream. And then the other issue is one of how do we hold the Trump administration accountable? Those two things are top of mind for me and the people that I talk about. And, we have to make sure that whoever leads has to put those front and center as far as I'm concerned.
Well, let's talk more about affordability and the economy, which, right, seemed to be one of the most pressing issues of the midterms. And raising the minimum wage has been something that all three of you major candidates have pitched in this race. And I believe, correct me if I'm wrong here, your number is $17 per hour. Is that correct?
Yeah, I'm a co-sponsor of the Raise the Wage Act. This is the piece of legislation that Bernie Sanders is spearheading to raise the minimum wage to $17 an hour.
Okay. And why is 17 the right number for you versus, right, Juliana Stratton has said 25 is her number?
Well, I think that right now, first of all, just so your listeners know, the minimum wage is $7.25 nationally, which is an abomination. It is completely unacceptable. In Illinois, it's 15. In many of our border states, including Republican-run states, it's $15. I think that going to 17 makes sense. I think that something that's much higher, such as $25, could really curtail hiring, especially by small businesses. As a former small businessman, I like to say I signed the front of the check and the back of the check, and it was it's not easy being a small business person. And as you know, small businesses provide the vast, vast majority of jobs in this country. In addition, you know, my second job in life was working at McDonald's. My first job was delivering papers for the Peoria Journal Star, but I don't think that McDonald's would have hired me at $25 an hour because I didn't know what I was doing. And that's true of much of youth employment, especially for entry-level jobs. And if we want to promote those experiences, which I think we do, then, you know, setting a minimum wage that's too high could lead businesses to do the opposite of hiring young people. And indeed, they probably would cut out a lot of this entry-level hiring.
And I know your two main primary opponents say they want to create Medicare for all. Is that something that you can get on board with?
If that bill were to come to a vote, I would say yes. But right now, the number one pressing issue is we got to deal with the five-alarm fire consuming our healthcare system, which is the fire instigated or sparked by Donald Trump. He has this thing called the Big Beautiful Bill. I call it the Large Lousy Law, which is going to lead to 13 million Americans losing their health insurance because of cuts to Medicaid. He refuses to extend the ACA tax credits, which means another 4 million Americans are going to lose their health insurance. So 17 million people are not going to have health insurance within a short period of time. And then on top of that, in Illinois, especially in rural areas, there are about 9 hospitals, including some close to the St. Louis area, that are going to lose, that are basically going to close because they're going to lose so many patients that they remain unviable. I visited one hospital in Clinton, and, you know, it is the only hospital for hours within a distance of people in that area. And if it were to close, it's not like these people would get would not get sick. It's just that they would get sick and go to emergency rooms in hospitals all across the area. And probably we, the taxpayers, would have to take care of them, but at a much higher cost.
I want to ask something that's top of mind for a lot of people right now, and that is that we have a tremendous amount of troops close to Iran, and it's very possible we might strike Iran, which has a 1 million-man army and a lot of ballistic missiles that are pointed not only at Israel, but our military bases, without Congress voting on anything. So number one, what do you think of this situation? And number two, should there be a War Powers Resolution vote before the president is allowed to attack a country at this type of magnitude?
Yes, there has to be a War Powers Resolution vote. I'm joining onto that War Powers Resolution. Look, the law and the Constitution are very clear. Only Congress and the people have the power to declare war, to deploy troops in armed hostilities. And that's what's going to happen here if Trump strikes Iran. This is not trivial by any means. First of all, I think that such a strike would trigger retaliation, and that retaliation would be directed obviously at our troops in the region or in other places. And we don't want another war. I haven't talked to a single person who wants war. We can't go to war. We don't want another endless war in the Middle East. But if the president feels strongly that military action is necessary, then he should come to Congress and seek a war powers resolution or an authorization to use military force. At the end of the day, look, I don't want Iran to have a nuclear weapon. I want them to end their ballistic missile program and their nefarious activities, including supporting terrorists throughout the Middle East. However, the best way to do that is at the bargaining table in concert with our friends, partners, and allies. Any other move would be misguided and dangerous and reckless, and I completely would oppose that right now.
And maybe speaking of other things that I would imagine you would like to see congressional approval of is tariffs. So the Supreme Court, right, recently ruled that the Trump administration was not justified in regulating importation under the law that they were using. And the next question is, does the federal government start paying an estimated $175 billion in tariff revenue that's been collected back? What do you think about that?
Yeah, I think they should. I think that, you know, in my constituency, but throughout Illinois, we're seeing people just getting devastated by tariffs, not just small businesses that are seeing tremendous costs escalate, causing them to even lay people off. But of course, families, because these are taxes. Tariffs are taxes. And so I'm glad that the Supreme Court struck down the president's illegal actions under the IEEPA, the International Economic Emergency Powers Act. I'm concerned that he's going to now do it under a different authority called Section 122. He's now instituted 15% global tariffs, which I think is possibly illegal as well. And yes, I believe that the tariff revenue, since it was illegally collected, should be refunded and people should enjoy the benefit of having that money back.
On immigration, I know from watching your television ads and from hearing you in debates that you want to abolish the iteration of ICE that Trump has created. But I guess I'll ask the same question that I asked to the other two candidates. Would you still want some separate governmental agency that enforces immigration laws? And if so, how would you want it to operate differently than either the Trump administration or even under like the Obama and Biden administration? Because I remember during Obama's administration, he got some criticism from the left for how ICE was operating. So what would you want ICE to be if it's not Trump's ICE?
Well, look, I have said we need to abolish Trump's ICE. This is a position shared by J.B. Pritzker and others for good reason. Here are some of the changes that I've talked about. One, Kristi Noem has got to go. Either she should be fired or impeached. Greg Bovino of the CBP needs to be removed as well. But in general, our CBP and ICE, it basically elements, any law enforcement official in DHS needs to be governed by similar authorities or practices as local law enforcement. So for instance, masks need to come off, ID needs to go on, body cameras need to go on. There cannot be warrantless arrests anymore. There have to be third party investigations of the use of force. In addition, we can't have roving gangs of CBP and ICE agents stirring up trouble in cities throughout the country, such as they have throughout Illinois. I disagree with Lieutenant Governor Stratton, who said it. I think she said to the Chicago Tribune that she thinks that the powers of ICE should be delegated to CBP. That doesn't make any sense to me because CBP is who killed Alex Preti in Minneapolis. Look, we need an enforcement function and certain functions to be performed regardless. For instance, one of the things that ICE and DHS enforce are child and human trafficking laws, for instance. But these need to be done in a different way. And right now, the way that they're being enforced, I believe, is illegal and indeed unconstitutional.
Got some Metro East specific questions to round out our conversation, Congressman. So first one, as part of Trump's One Big Beautiful Bill, 21 Missouri zip codes were added into the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act, but the single zip code on the Illinois side of the river that covers Venice, Madison, and Granite City did not make it into the final legislation. So I'm wondering if you're elected to the Senate, would that be something that you'd push for, that zip code's inclusion into RECA, as it's known?
Yes.
Why so?
Again, I think that he's doing this for political reasons. The White House appears to make these moves based on whether certain zip codes, indeed states, are somehow supportive of their political agenda, not whether on the merits they deserve to be included. And so I think this is, again, another example of being excluded for partisan political reasons, and it's wrong.
I wanted to also ask about the role that the Trump administration has taken in private business. So in the deal between the Japanese company Nippon and U.S. Steel, the Trump administration has what's known as a golden share, right, which gives the federal government a board seat and veto authority in U.S. Steel's decision-making. And according to the Trump administration, they used that to prevent the closure of Granite City Works, the steel mill here in the Metro East. And the CEO of U.S. Steel said, no, that's not actually how it worked. But anyway, what do you make of the Trump administration's golden share or maybe profit sharing deals like they've negotiated with the chipmaker NVIDIA?
A couple things. One is this golden share concept is something that's employed by another entity that's commonly known to many Americans. That's called the Chinese Communist Party. That is how the CCP operates and controls the private sector. So I'm concerned about a situation where the government essentially starts to control the decision-making of private businesses. And again, going back to the previous question, does so for political or partisan reasons and puts pressure on those companies to do the bidding, essentially the political bidding of the chief executive or the president, okay? The second is more particular to Trump himself, which is that he and his family put their private personal business interests often ahead of the public interest. And you see this on foreign policy, especially. You see how, you know, certain countries in the Middle East, for instance, get favorable treatment because they made special deals with the Trump family with regard to some of their business concerns. What I'm concerned about is if he starts having these quote unquote golden shares or veto power over the decision-making of certain companies, he basically uses that as leverage to get something for the family. And I think that would be disastrous for American free enterprise and public policy. And it would hurt the government, it would hurt business, it would hurt all of us.
Final question for you. Cahokia Heights, this is a suburb that has really aging and decrepit sewer systems that's left folks with backed up sewers, flooded basements, and illnesses. And it's an issue that's kind of persisted for a long time. And the residents always say, we see maybe money is moving, infrastructure projects are happening, but we still have problems. So if you're elected the next senator from Illinois, how would you want to go about fixing this longstanding problem?
I think this is something that should fall squarely within the group of kind of top priorities for a Senate office, because this problem, by the way, is not isolated to Cahokia Heights. There are other parts of Illinois that have situations, infrastructure situations, that are just unacceptable. You know, one part of a district in the northern part of Illinois still doesn't have running water. Like their water is not potable, and so they're forced to, you know, get distributions of water bottles from their municipality or township still. That doesn't make any sense. In 2026, how can we allow that to persist? So yes, this would be one of those kind of basic priorities that we would have to address. And if I'm privileged to be the next U.S. Senator, what I would do is I would try to figure out, working with local stakeholders and the administration and our appropriators, how do we address these kind of very basic issues as much as possible? And, you know, in my own district, we have a problem of lead service lines. And so I've secured funding specifically for that through my congressional office. So as a backstop, I would want to do that through the community project funding grant process as well, which senators and members of the House are able to take advantage of.
Before we let you go, where should people find out more about you if they're curious about your campaign or you?
www.rajaforil.com.
Perfect. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Politically Speaking is a product of St. Louis Public Radio, a listener-supported service of the University of Missouri, St. Louis. Until next time, so long.
If you have a smart speaker, you have access to the entire world of NPR and St. Louis Public Radio. All the latest news and all the captivating stories. Activate our voices with yours by telling your smart speaker to play St. Louis Public Radio.